Hi, Sarah O'Kelly here with Skipper's Review, and I'm going to be talking to Pete Bethune for Boat Radio, and we are actually at the Fort Lauderdale International Boat Show, where Pete is displaying his wares, as in his new show, or is it a new show? You tell me in a minute. It's called The Operatives, so give me the rundown on The Operatives.
So what we do is I've got a team of former military guys, and we help countries with fisheries enforcement and anti-poaching. And so normally it's countries that don't have a lot of money, so Africa and Central America and Asia. And we just come in and offer them help for free. And then the television show covers those missions. And that's largely how I go paying for our work and what we do. And one of the challenges you have in conservation is how can you sell that show on television? Like if you make a television show about conservation, it's actually really hard to get people to watch that. And so we try and take people on a journey on the show where there's a really nice story arc of some reasonably talented guys who do the best to go out and target illegal fishing and wildlife poaching and these things. And I think the show airs in about 20 countries now, so it's getting out there. And we're just
how long have you been doing it?
We filmed the first series in 2013, and then last season we filmed series two, and then we're just getting ready now for season three in Africa. So it's getting out there, but television's a tough game, and you can't tell the same story every time. Like if I had my way, I'm just going to go out and target illegal fishing. That's what I love doing. But you can only show so many episodes of Pete and his team grabbing another fishing boat, and so we need to keep coming up with fresh ways or fresh projects or missions that highlight maybe a different cause. And so it's seen us go a lot more into the jungle in recent times, just going targeting say Sumatran rhino poachers and elephant poachers and things like that. And then with series three in Africa will be a lot more sort of what you might consider hardcore missions. So we're going, for example, to Democratic Republic of Congo, which is an extremely brutal place now. A lot of issues with the civil war and guerrilla groups in the jungles where we're going. And it kind of means our show has some serious risk involved, but it means we're not having to fabricate risk or pretend that things are dangerous or that, because there is genuine risk involved in what we do.
Do you have to use any weaponry when you...
It depends on the country. As an example, in Costa Rica, it was illegal for us to have any weapons there. And so in some cases, we partnered with the local enforcement units. And in other cases, we did our own thing, but without weapons. We try and operate within the law of the countries that we're operating in. And increasingly, we are working with legitimate enforcement agencies. But it's not always possible. And, sometimes there's corruption and other issues in a country where we might go and do our own thing, but in those cases we definitely won't be armed or just get us in too much trouble.
And so when you get in there and you do stuff like, say, in what we were just talking about, rhinos, their horns are right, they're just ripped off, and you will catch a few people doing that, and then you leave. Is there something that you leave behind that can continue on after you leave?
Yeah, we generally have three main goals when we run a campaign. The first one is to train up local units. And our team doesn't claim to have all the answers. We do have some skill sets. And as an example, I've had a couple of guys who are former Navy SEALs. I've had a former SAS guy, a guy from the 1ER regiment in France. So these are genuine special operations guys. So they bring a certain skill set and knowledge base that we try and impart that on the local units that we work with. And then it's two-way, though. Like, very often, last year, especially in the Sumatran jungle, we learn a truckload off the local units, and especially in terms of bushcraft and things like that. So it's a two-way street. We walk away having a broader depth of knowledge, and the local units go away having trained with some guys and hopefully some skills they didn't have. So that's the first thing, is training of local units. Second thing is we do want to go catching bad guys. So every poacher we can put away, it is a good result. And sometimes it might only be a fine, sometimes it might be a warning, but there are cases where there is serious imprisonment and confiscation of boats or gear or something, which is part of a goal. And then the third thing is we want to tell the story of what's happening. If general populations in Western countries, for example, if they know about something like shark finning or the rhino trade, the elephant trade, the pangolin trade, which is one we covered last year. It makes it easier for governments in Western countries to go supporting governments in Asia and Africa to help them do the protection. Africa, as an example, and West Africa, they have a serious problem with wildlife poaching there, but they have no money. And the aid that comes in to help them, a lot of it comes from places like America and Europe. And the more the populations in those countries know about the issue, the more likely they are to make a donation to help someone who's doing it, or the more likely it is for a government of Europe to go putting some money into, you know, say, Guinea-Bissau or Liberia to help them with their fisheries or wildlife protection.
And will that money then go to the government of the said country, or will it go to an organization who will send their people over to...
It depends on the situation. In some cases, it's direct money that goes to the government. Examples would be vessels. So a lot of the countries in West Africa, they have no vessels to do their fisheries patrols, or they might have a 6-meter runabout, and you know that's supposed to protect 200 nautical miles offshore. And so there have been cases of significant vessels that were donated. Another example would be the U.S. Coast Guard at the moment is removing their island class cutters. These are 110 foot island class cutter, and these are being donated or sold very cheaply to poorer countries to give them an asset to use for fisheries. And so we try and encourage that process and say, hey, you know, why don't you go and approach the US and see if you can get one of the Coast Guard cutters that's coming up. But some of the money too goes directly to NGOs, and there is quite literally thousands of NGOs around the world working on conservation issues, and one of the ways that they get money is through something like our television show, encouraging people to get out and donate, not necessarily to us, get out and support an NGO that you think does good work and that's deserving of your support.
So 50%, roughly, say 50% of your work is in the marine, you say is your favorite spot. Where are you seeing the most trouble there now, between the shark finning and the illegal fishing, and what are you targeting?
The biggest target I have is foreign vessels fishing illegally, and the type of fishing they do, it varies enormously. In terms of sheer take would be the trawlers and the purse seiners. And the Chinese fleet especially, a lot of them are from their national fleet. They're owned by the Chinese government, and they are all through the South China Sea, all through the West and East Africa. And the world pays a heavy price for illegal fishing by Chinese vessels, but they're not the only ones. We see Taiwan and Korea have a lot of illegal fishing vessels. And also in Africa, as the northern Atlantic has been cleaned out, you've seen some of the European vessels, like from Spain and Portugal and Greece, heading down through Africa. And you know, some of them come in long line, but the bulk of the damage I see is done by the trawlers and the purse seiners. And to give you the numbers, a single large foreign vessel from, say, China, typically will take 20 tonnes of fish in a day. The average local person in West Africa takes 20 kilos. So that single trawler has taken the equivalent of 1,000 local fishermen. And there's a compounding effect that goes on, and that one local fisherman who was catching that 20 kilos, he's not just dependent on it. There's the people who fix the nets, there's the people who work on the outboard motors, the people who build the boats, and there's all these other people. So as the fishing industry declines, it doesn't impact just the fishermen, but their families and all the other people that are dependent on it. And there's a double whammy that happens in conservation, and that as your fishery stocks decline, it pushes people to look for other sources of animal protein. And in Africa, it's their wildlife. And there's been a massive increase in what's called the bushmeat trade. And this, they target all things from lizards and snakes and monkeys and kudu and antelope, and all these animals are being harvested now in record numbers to satisfy the bushmeat trade. And the bushmeat trade has become more lucrative as the fisheries have dried up. And so if we can prevent these foreign vessels from going in and protect the fishery for local people, it has a really positive impact on the environment, and that hopefully there's less bushmeat trade happening because of it.
Now, China have been, you say, are causing the most trouble at the moment. How long have they been doing it, and how hard is it going to be to get them to change their ways and to wake up?
The really challenging thing with China is they have become a global superpower in the last maybe 15 years, and and I wasn't doing illegal fishing until about 5 years ago, but sort of from what I've seen and what I've read, the Chinese growth and their outreach in their illegal fishing started about 10 years ago, and much of it was to do with the national fleet where China was building thousands of boats each year that were being sent out around the world. And you see it now, especially in Africa, where they don't have vessels to go patrolling their fisheries. You know, some do, like South Africa and Namibia have a few vessels, but much of Africa doesn't. And China's become the big dog there. You know, you see American, they have the odd destroyer and frigate over there, but their impact is relatively low. And often they're more interested in people smuggling or trying to stop piracy rather than illegal fishing. China's hard to stop, and
what are you doing to go about it? How do you approach it?
I think it's got to be a long game, and we do need people like the US government and European governments to step up. But it's very hard to get. For example, you've got Spain and Portugal; their fishing fleet is heavily subsidised by the European Union, and they are busy down there catching fish in West Africa while being subsidised. And to try and get Spain to come in and lean on China, if there's enough countries leaning on China, eventually China will get the message. But it's a long game, and the odds of China withdrawing their national fleet or encouraging all of their private vessels back into Chinese waters in the next 5 years is very remote. It's going to take a long, long game, and it's
is
going
it
to take
education. Is it awareness?
It's a combination of things that will. It's a number of things will lead to this. I'll give you an example. Would be shark finning.
Yeah.
You know, the price of shark fin has started to reduce in China, and there's anecdotal evidence that consumption is declining, and it's taken considerable effort over the last 10 years by many NGOs and individuals and government that's actually led to that reduction. It's a long game, and we're not out of the woods on shark finning yet, but it is heading in the right direction. But it's taken many different things to contribute that. Now, I think the illegal fishing by trawlers and purseiners, it's the same. Government has a role to play. NGOs have a role to play. My organisation, in terms of making the television show and catching these Chinese vessels fishing illegally, has a role to play as well. And, you know, hopefully long-term too, the consumers in China, you know, ultimately they're the people who are buying all this fish that's been taken illegally. And if you can reduce that demand, or you can make them start demanding, you know, we want to see evidence that our fish is legally harvested rather than stolen from poor countries in Africa. It'd be a good thing.
Yeah, it's a long road because tradition and heritage is a tough thing to break.
Yeah, well, there's two issues there. One of them is what you might consider the traditional medicines, and that has a greatest impact on what I consider endangered wildlife. Like shark fin is simply a food. It's a luxury food that's typically had at weddings or special events. But in terms of their traditional medicines, that tends to be more your land wildlife. So for example, one of the missions we did last year was we broke up two rings that were smuggling pangolin out of the Philippines to China. Now pangolin is this little animal that's kind of a cross
sloth
between
looking kind of,
yeah,
right?
A little bit like a sloth and an anteater.
Adorable.
But with these scales on it, like they're cool little creatures, but
yeah.
They, you know, the traditional medicine says that the scales of these, the Chinese woman who have problems with lactation or breastfeeding issues, supposedly these scales will help that lactation. But under, you know, there's been no peer-reviewed scientific papers to justify this. It's just simply, you know, witchcracker. And even if it is correct, they're a critically endangered species. Like, even if there is some merit to what they say, you can't justify taking a species extinct because you have an issue with breastfeeding your baby. And so in that, we filmed these episodes targeting these wildlife criminals. And, you know, we made some bust, made a great episode of television and got the story out there. But to stop that demand in China is really hard, and that needs a long game. And more than anything, it needs the Chinese government to start clamping down on the trade of that in China. And we had a biologist who went and visited China, and you could find those, you just walk in any of those shops, and in some cases they'll have it on display, others you'll say, you know, hey, have you got any pangolin? You know, oh sure, here it is here, and I'll bring it out. Like it's not, that market hasn't gone underground yet. To try and buy rhino horn is a little bit more underground there. Like China's come under pressure on that. So I think in the long term, eventually we need China to take ownership of that, and that's only going to happen when...
Has the elephant thing slowed down?
The price of ivory has reduced, and interestingly there, America was the second largest importer of ivory behind China. You know, I would have thought it would have been Vietnam or Malaysia, somewhere like that. But it was actually America. And there was a loophole that allowed people to import it, saying that it's antique, so it had to be over so many years old. If I hand you a piece of ivory, you can't tell us it's 1 year old or 100 years. You can't tell. And so the ivory trade continued with most of it going to China, but second most amount was coming to America. And they make chess pieces and walking sticks and all sorts of crazy stuff out of it. But America has closed that loophole now. And so you genuinely have to be able to prove this is an antique piece to bring it in.
That maybe will help then the rhino, because it's kind of, okay, now we've battled for the elephants and now it's on to the rhino.
Rhino horn as an issue has been on the radar for a number of years. And there's evidence that the price is reducing for rhino horn, but it's taken a long time and it has a long way to go. And rhino, I think, is one of the very tough ones to stop. Like the price is so huge. Like a poacher is going to get $5,000 for a horn, and by the time that horn ends up in China, you know, that's $20,000 to $30,000 worth of product on a single rhino horn. To try and stop that demand is very hard. And what's happened in Africa? It's become a battlefield. Like if you take Kruger National Park and the surrounding parts around it, they have shot and killed over the last few years 500 poachers. 500, like in any other country, that is a war going on. And what's happened now, it doesn't even make the news unless there's, you know, four poachers killed at once will make the news. And it pisses me off sometimes that, you know, I'll put a post up and say something about what's happening in Africa, and all these people sitting behind their computers will sort of say, oh, this is atrocious, I wish those South Africans would sort it out. They're doing their best to try and sort it out, but it's a war zone. And South Africa has zero influence over China. They can't stop the demand in China. So, you know, in some ways I wish they were doing a little bit more, but it's not an easy battle. And, you know, the hope is that, you know, a team like mine can come in and help them a little bit, and lots of other NGOs help them a little bit, and the US government steps up pressure on China to stop the demand and to push it more underground, so at least it's harder for people to go buying the thing. So these battles are not easy, and it's a long game, and it needs pressure from all sources, NGOs, individuals, governments, people posting, writing letters, governments stepping in and doing things, and ultimately, hopefully, the Chinese people finally standing up and saying, hey, I'm not going to get rhino horn for my stag party.
So let's talk about your arrest and hopping on that Japanese boat to give the captain what for with your $3 million receipt.
Yeah, so what happened with that? I was in Antarctica with an organization called Sea Shepherd. We'd spent some time disrupting the Japanese whaling program. And we had a pretty cool boat that was named Daddy Gill at that stage. And we disrupted them and harassed them and tried to slow them down and stop their whaling activities. And then there was on one of the days, I think it was January the 6th or something, we'd effectively run out of fuel. And we'd sort of done our job as best we could, but I was going to have to sit there and wait for 2 days for the Steve Irwin, another ship, to come and refuel us. So I told my engineer, who was at the helm at the time, to stop. So we stopped, and Shonomaru, the Japanese security vessel, who we'd already had a few altercations with, they pulled up, they were coming down our port side, and at the last second they turned to starboard and ran us over. And it busted the bow off the vessel. And I initially I thought, oh,
okay, what do you mean they came down? You were just, explain the ran you over part.
So we had one engine at idle and in gear. So we're going along at about 4 knots. And the Shonomaru, the security vessel, they pulled up on our port side and they were doing about 18 knots, so quite fast. And they were going to pass on our port side, but then the captain who's driving the boat, he turned to starboard and came in and he's going to hit us. And my guy driving, he looks out the back and he sees this boat bearing down on us. So he tries to turn to starboard. And the problem we have in Earth Race, when you're going slow, the rudders have very little traction. And he had, at that stage, he had the starboard engine only in gear. So he put the port engine in gear, turned the wheel to starboard to try and turn away from the Shonan Maru. But the problem was the Shonan Maru was doing 18 knots, we're only doing 4, and the bow of the vessel came basically crashing down a wave on top of us, and it split the bow off the boat. So now we've got this, you know, this carbon race boat, if you like, with no bow, completely busted in half.
So a few feet and it would have come down right on top of you.
Oh, like if the Shonan Maru had turned, you know, 10 metres earlier, we would have had people in body bags. No question on that.
So how did you get on board to give your what?
Well,
what happened
after that was we'd had plans on trying to get one of my crew onto a Japanese vessel. The challenge we had in the whaling issue was it was never a story that Japanese media covered. They completely ignored it, and it didn't matter what we did down there. And an example, the ramming of the Adi Gill, it never actually made the TV news in Japan. Not a single TV news item. It made page 4, page 5 stories with a little thing about, you know, the Adi Gill is suffering navigational difficulties. And we go, our bow was lost. So one of the ways around that I'd thought of was if we had one of my men got aboard a Japanese vessel and they'd take him back to Japan as a prisoner, my feeling was it would take that story to Japan and it would get them talking about it finally. So after they ran my boat over, Sea Shepherd made the decision to abandon the boat in Antarctica. I got aboard the Steve Irwin, which is one of the Sea Shepherd vessels, and then I proposed to Paul Watson. I said, what do you think about me boarding the Shonan Maru and presenting them a bill for $3 million to replace the vessel that they'd run over? And from a maritime perspective, the Shonan Maru definitely in the wrong. Like, they were the overtaking vessel and the portside vessel. So under both scenarios, they've got to keep well clear of me. But in Antarctica, I think the rule of maritime law was long gone.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was if it came to a court case, I believe the Japanese would lose. So I made so many attempts, probably half a dozen attempts, to try and get aboard the Shonan Maru. But it's really hard. Like, they've got these water cannons, they've got a thing called an LRAD, which is a military acoustic device, which is super loud. So it makes it hard, you can't talk, and some people it makes you kind of a bit nauseous and ringing in your ears. You've got to wear ear protection, and it's quite a difficult thing. They've got anti-boarding spikes along the side of the boat, so these big massive steels. It's to stop us boarding the boat, to stop people like me trying to get aboard. So these anti-boarding spikes, and if you get a rib under there, it'll just puncture your boat and you're going to sink. And then they've got these nets, anti-boarding nets, to stop you getting on, and they've got guys running around with what's called an impulse gun, which is a thing used for crowd control, and they put pepper spray in them. And so, all up, it's really hard to get aboard that boat. And so after about 5 or 6 failed attempts, I hatched this plan to do it at night. And we had some night vision and some pretty cool kit. So I figured we could actually put together this mission to get aboard.
Well, wait, with the other 4 or 5 attempts, what happened to you when you tried to get on?
I couldn't get close enough. Every time we get close, the fire's on you, the fire hoses are on you, the LRAD is on you, this guy standing there with bamboo poles really ready to smack you. And
you just fall back into the water, or you fall back into the boat?
In
what
the
happens?
End, we never actually got close enough to do that. And it did become clear, with these anti-boarding spikes, if you drive under there with a rib, like, for you to get close enough for me to jump on that boat, you're going to lose your boat, because these anti-boarding spikes are going to come down and puncture your rib. So it just became, you know, and we, every time we got in close, they had the pepper spray, these impulse guns firing pepper spray at us. And so it was just really, really tough. And eventually I finally reached a conclusion. The only way is to get on there at night so they won't see.
What about helicopter?
In fact, we did look at me parachuting down onto the thing.
Of course you did.
We did. In fact, we did have a couple parachutes on the Steve Irwin. So it was proposed, but I was willing to do it, but Chris Altman, who was the helicopter pilot, he didn't want to do it, and he was worried about, and rightly so, losing his license.
Oh,
like, as a chopper pilot, you know, you're dependent on your license for your livelihood, and if it was, you know, if the operation went significantly pear-shaped, and that's a high-risk mission, for you to drop a guy from, say, 5,000 feet, and he's got a parachute down on the boat, that could easily turn pear-shaped, and especially at that stage. Like, I've done some jumps, but you know, that's next
level.
So the
sneak approach is much subtler.
The sneak approach, I figured, was our best chance to pull it off.
Yeah, yeah.
But still not, like, I still figured it was, you know, I, I remember thinking we had about a 20 to 30% chance of pulling it off.
Like, it is a tough mission. Were you afraid
for your life? Oh, yeah, absolutely, I was afraid.
Like, even once you get through all the battlefields and you get on board, did you feel that they would maybe kill you once you got on board?
I didn't think they would kill me, but I was worried they would throw me overboard. And this Antarctica, like, the water temperature there is typically between sort of 3 degrees to about -1, like freezing point down there because of the salinity of the water. It actually freezes.
And you're not
beneath
very movable
zero.
In a 10 millimeter.
Well, I wasn't in a wetsuit, but I had a combat dry suit and then like a sleeping bag thing underneath, and so it's quite restrictive. And I've got a lot of kit. Like, I've got this safety vest. I've got an EPUB on. I've got flares. I've got, you know, like, I'm well kitted up, but I'm quite heavy and relatively inflexible in terms of my ability to do physical exertion to try and board this thing. So anyway, eventually, I hatched this plan. My engineer Larry, he says, "Oh, that's right. We figured out there was one of the anti-boarding spikes missing. So boarding spikes are about 2 meters apart, but there was one place where one of them had been broken off or wasn't there for some reason. And when I sat there doing the numbers, figured our jet ski is 3.5 meters long and there's a 4 meter gap, so we could just slot the jet ski in between those anti-boarding spikes
on a calm day.
We never really had a calm day. Like, yeah. On the day we ran the mission, it was the best weather window we had, but there was still half a meter chop and 2 meter of swell, and that 2 meter swell was what affected us the most. So that has the Shonan Maru rolling up and down, and so when the boat's rolling up, we're underneath the spikes, but as that vessel, as the side comes down, these spikes go down and hit the water. So if your jet ski is under those spikes, you're toast.
Done.
Yeah, so it was reasonably high risk. And in the end, Larry took me alongside and we banged into the side of the boat. And the jet ski, we had three of us on there. Jet skis are tricky and this wasn't a really massive jet ski. And Animal Planet had been desperate to put a cameraman on to film all this. In the end, he's a guy that had done like 5 seasons of Deadliest Catch. He said after, he said he shit his pants so much. And he said, basically, as soon as he got on board the jet ski, we started going, he said, like, fuck this, I'm just going to put my camera away. And he never filmed it. He never actually filmed the whole thing. He started filming when they got back to near the Steve Irwin again, after they'd already kind of dropped me off. But anyway, as we pulled in, we came in. Larry, we hit the side a couple of times, and then he kind of got it settled against the side of the Shonan Maru. And this, I think, in terms of time, was about 3 a.m, which we figured was like the blackest point of the night. And I climbed up, got on the side, but the net was sort of preventing me being able to just jump in. And as the boat swung back to the port side, it rolled over and a wave came up and caught my legs, and, you know, I'm clinging onto this net, but the wave just swept me off. And then there was like, suddenly it's like in the water, and then I sort of pop back up and I see the Shonan Maru disappearing, and where's the jet ski? Like, I can't see the jet ski. And I was sitting there, and I did have a flare. And, you know, I can set the flare off.
So you're in the water now with the flare.
So I'm in the water, yeah.
Okay.
And then I was in the water maybe about 2 minutes. And Larry, my engineer, as soon as I got on, I was going to call him on the radio and say, the Kiwi has landed, was what I was going to say. And so Larry's listening to the radio because it's pitch black. He can't see. And the night vision, just with the water coming over the top, it was next to useless. So he didn't hear the radio call. So he said one of two things. Either I got on board and my radio's damaged, which is good. The second option is I fell in the water, in which case I'm in the water back there. So he just made the call. He said, I'm going to follow back through the path. And then, so I'm lying in the water, and then suddenly there's this jet ski about to run me over. And it's funny when I talk to Larry 6 months later about what he did and what I did.
Oh,
like, I've never been so happy to see a jet ski. So anyway, he picked me up, second attempt, and I got on. And the same thing kind of happened, but as the wave came up, it wasn't as high as the first one, and it got up to about my knee.
So you went back and attempted again.
Yeah.
As soon as you got back on the jet ski and said, oh yeah, let's go do this.
But
again.
I do remember thinking, like, I was, you know, the whole Sea Shepherd team has all put a lot of effort into getting me into this position, and you're not wanting to let the team down. And it was exhausting, bashing around on that jet ski, this big swell, these waves hitting us. And I remember thinking, I've only got 3 or 4 attempts and I will be too exhausted to be able to keep trying this. And sooner or later, I knew, when we were banging into the side, it is going to wake someone up sooner or later. So anyway, on the second attempt, Larry pulled in.
Oh, right, because all the beds are right down underneath there, right?
Yeah,
where the
it's by the cabins, yeah. So sooner or later, someone's going to wake, or someone's going to be walking around, and, hello, what's this jet ski doing following us along? Anyway, second attempt, got on the side, and as the vessel sort of swung out, I'm clinging onto this net, and I kind of fall away from the boat, and I'm out at, like, maybe 45 degrees, but the wave only comes up just maybe up to my knees, and I'm staying there, and then the boat swings back over, and as soon as it was past the vertical, I had a knife down in my boot, pulled the knife out, cut a hole in the net, and jumped on, and it was the most extraordinary feeling. Like, I knew I'd made a little bit of history, and our team had made some history that day. I was nervous, like, now I'm on this vessel that certainly won't light me on there. I was sure that someone would have come out to, because
we're stage two. Now you're on. Now what do you do? Yeah.
And it is amazing how sometimes your life can change in the space of a few seconds. And I'd say when the boat got rammed was one of them. And I think the second one was when I boarded that Shonan Maru. Like, my life was forever going to be different. And, you know, it could be in good ways, could be in bad ways. So I got on the vessel and I went down and saw it. I spent about 10 minutes just hiding. I got on the radio, the Kiwis landed to Larry, and then Larry was able to radio back to the steward to say, hey, we've got Pete on board. And, you know, everyone on those two boats was up sort of listening and you know, following
screaming.
In fact, and I think a lot of them thought I wouldn't be able to do it. Like, it was a tricky mission, and in some ways I just got lucky. Like, it was a pretty audacious plan.
Persistence.
But it did. Japan paid a heavy price for it, and I was very lucky to be part of the team that made that happen. And once I got on board that boat, I was going to be a headache for those Japanese, no two ways about it. So anyway, I hid for about 10 minutes, then I went up and sort of started exploring the back deck and the upper deck of the boat. There was one time when what turned out to be their bosun, he came out and did a patrol around the boat, and I just kept hiding. And then I went around checking hatches to see which hatches were open. Went inside, went down into the engine room and a few other places.
Oh my God. Okay,
just sneaking around. I found out later, I left a little blood trail because I cut my hand on a piece of metal when I boarded the boat. So I had a hand that was bleeding, and it was, yeah, it was, I could, I'd wanted to use gloves, but with the gloves, what I'd done is I'd basically taken my gloves off straight before the mission, because I needed to have feeling in my hands, and gloves, you're not as able to cling on to things as well. So I end up, I cut my hand open, I've left this trail of blood all over through the show tomorrow. And then when we eventually got to Japan, one of them, they said, oh, you went in here, and I had no recollection of it, but that my blood was through that there. So I can't remember. But anyway, so I spent a couple of hours, and I didn't want the crew to find me until daybreak, when I could get the helicopter off the Steve Irwin to come and film. And that, I thought, if they throw me in the water, the chopper can come pick me up. You know, not an easy mission for a chopper that ain't designed to land in the water. Like, it would be tricky to do that, but it's not impossible. And worst case is the chopper could keep an eye on me and they could launch one of the ribs or something off the other boat. So
where are you hiding?
So I hid underneath on the upper deck. There was a banner that sort of something had www.icrwhale.org, which is the whalers' website. And they have that there, so when the chopper is filming, that they get a bit of their website address
on
it there. So I'm hiding under, there was about a 1 foot gap between the deck level and that. So I just hid under there until daybreak. And then right on daybreak, the chopper came out and started filming. And I walked down the deck, and I'm pretty cold by now. I've been out maybe for 2 or 3 hours. And despite having this dry suit on and a sleeping bag, whatever, I was pretty cold.
And adrenaline and everything else.
Yeah, and by then the adrenaline had kind of worn off. Like, and you know, now I'm getting a bit excited, a bit nervous, and you don't know what they're going to do. Like, you know, when you're the captain of a boat and if someone boards your boat without your permission, like, you are angry. You know, it's like a violation. And I didn't know what these guys would do. So
especially when you think you're sleeping in bed all comfy and cozy because you protected your boat 10 different ways, and yet still somebody managed to get on board.
And when I went down to present that bill, like, oh, I was shitting my pants. I was really nervous. And anyway, so I went up to the door, and I kind of knocked on the door, and there was, at the time, I think there was three crew in there, and you could see them, sort of like, oh, blah, 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 and they all start talking. And then within about 2 minutes, there was about eight people all in there, and the guy that turned out to be the captain, he comes running over and he locks the door in front of me. And I sort of, you know, I said, like your hatches are all open. Like, you know, if you want to keep me out, it's
not going to work.
Anyway, so, and I hold this, I've got a note that says, I'm the captain of the Adi Gill. I'm here to see the captain of the Shonan Maru.
Written in Japanese.
Yeah, written in Japanese. So anyway, I'm holding that note up to the window, and these people running around, and the captain, he comes out and he opens the door beside me and he looks out the back and he thinks that I've just boarded off one of the ribs. So he's looking to see where the boat is. He's looking up at the chopper and scratching his head. And thinking, what's that? So he didn't quite know what happened at this stage. Anyway, he closes the door and as he goes back inside, I kind of slipped in behind him because I'm cold. I'm freezing cold. I'm not wanting to stay inside anymore. So I just slipped in behind him and talk about a party you haven't been invited to, eh? Like, I'm even looking at, and it, like, everyone's silent. They're all standing there looking at me, and I'm looking at them. Like, it was this sort of stand-up, like, you know, what happens now? And so I hand over this note, and it's got my demand letter. And then about the same time, we had a Japanese translator on the steward, and she calls up the steward on the radio, and she goes through what the demand is on my letter and some additional information. And so basically the demand was I'm holding him responsible for the destruction of my boat. I want $3 million to replace it. If he's unprepared to do that, I'm going to stay on this boat. I'm refusing to go back on the sea ship, but it's not going to come pick me up. And I'm refusing to be handed over to anyone. I want him to take me to New Zealand, Australia. So this is a bluff. And I knew he would never take me to New Zealand, Australia, because if he did, he could be prosecuted for the ramming of my vessel. So he's not going to take me to New Zealand, Australia. He's got a couple options. He could transfer me to an Australian vessel or whatever. But by saying I want to go to Australia and New Zealand, it made that less likely. And so there was a couple options from there. One is that he'd take me back to Japan, which is what I wanted. Or he might try and drop me in the Philippines or Malaysia or somewhere that is kind of on the way. And I found out later that they did in fact try getting the Philippines to take me, but it had become a hot potato by then. They didn't have anything to do with me. Yeah, so
your reasoning for wanting to end up in Japan was to make Japan aware of what was going on.
Yeah, to get the story of Japanese whaling and how offensive it is to New Zealanders and Australians. The idea of offence, it resonates with Japanese. Like, they don't like to offend people. And at the same token, they don't like to be offended themselves. And so they try and be a very respectful people in that regard. And all I did, every time I had any media interviews, I would say, this is offensive to New Zealanders and Australians. You guys are whaling in our backyard, in an area where you have no long history of whaling, and in an area that New Zealand and Australia thinks of as their own. It's complicated in Antarctica. Like, it's the search and rescue zone for Australia and New Zealand where they do go. New Zealand, Australia has territorial claims on the area. Those claims aren't recognised by most countries, but nonetheless, New Zealand, Australia has claimed them. And we have bases down there. The area is a whale sanctuary as declared by the International Whaling Commission, of which Japan is a signatory. And Japan's legal merit for going down there is very bogus. Like, they say it's for scientific research, and there's a clause in the original regulations that the IWC set up in the 40s that says a country can conduct scientific research in anywhere they like, basically, but it's got to be genuine scientific research. And while I was in prison in Japan, in some ways it was when the world woke up to whaling. Like, it became a massive story in Japan and globally. It went all over the world, especially the footage of me getting aboard and then my incarceration. And every time the court case came up, like, you know, I was in and out of court, you know, over the following 5 months many times.
You're in prison for 5 months, right?
I'm in prison for 5 months. And every time I went to court, there was 500 protesters outside. There was every news agency was there covering it. And so I got massive traction in Japan. The demand for whale in 2010 dropped 30% in Japan. And not only because I was there. There was a combination of things that led to that. But certainly the ramming of the Addie Girl, the story of me being in Japan, and the various NGOs and governments that all started talking to Japan about whaling, it did put pressure on Japan. Eventually, it also put pressure on New Zealand and Australia. You know, hey, you've got these guys going down to Antarctica risking their lives. Why aren't you doing something about it? And so eventually Australia announced the court action to take Japan to the International Court of Justice. It took 4 years for the case to reach its fruition. Japan lost. The following year, they stopped whaling in Antarctica. But then the year just gone, they've gone back and they've cut their program from 1,000 whales down to 333. So it's not perfect, but I'll take 333 whales over 1,000 any day. And And I go back to my point earlier, sometimes these things are a long game, and it may be 10 or 15 or 20 years before eventually Japan stops whaling in Antarctica, but I believe it will stop eventually, just not as soon as it might.
Yeah, amazing. So where do you think all this came from, all this passion for conservation and saving the wildlife?
It's funny how I never set out to be a conservationist. When I finished school, I went and worked in the oil industry. I went through the Middle East and the North Sea. I was busy making money, really. But in some ways, that early career, it gave me a lot of skills that I use now in my work. You know, an ability to get the job done regardless of what you've got, do the best with what you've got. And often, we wish we had more equipment and more men and more resource, but do the best with what you've got. And the company Schlumberger, who I was working for, they were really good on teaching their engineers that you've got a limited amount of people and resource, you go and do your best with it. And so I worked in the oil industry, that's like being on the dark side.
A little bit.
And then I went back to New Zealand. I didn't want to end up a sad engineer with a, in the end, I went back to New Zealand, got married, had a couple of kids. And then it was about 2003 or 2004. I was in Australia doing an MBA. And to finish the degree off, I wrote a 20,000 word project, Alternative Fuels for Road Transport. And through that, having had a really good grounding in the energy industry, the report solidified my views on biofuels. Like, I do think they've got a genuine role to play in reducing our total dependence on fossil fuels. They're not a panacea for transport energy, but they can come in and they are starting to play a role. So I decided to build this boat to promote biofuels. And after then, I've done nothing special. Not that I claim it was special, but I had this idea, I'm going to build this very cool boat, fuel it on biodiesel.
This is where the engineering comes in.
Yeah. And I'm good on technology, and I didn't have anything to do with boats before, but what I wanted to do was build the world's coolest boat and set a record to circle the globe and fuel it on this biodiesel fuel made from waste cooking oils and use it as a positive promotion. And I bumbled around. Like, it took me a year to figure out what I was going to do, and then it was another full year to raise the money and get some sponsors on board. Then to build the boat was a year. So initially I'm thinking, this is going to be a one-year project. I didn't even... It took me 3 years to get the boat in the water. And then there was a year where we did a promotional tour and come over the States and a few other areas. And then we made the first record attempt and failed miserably. Ended up just too many problems, bad decisions on my part, some other things that we could have done a lot better. So in the end, we failed miserably, and a year later, went back and did the record, and worse, it was successful. We broke the world record by 2 weeks, and the record still stands today. So it's funny now, looking at it, like the record served a purpose. So there's actually a trophy for this, and the guy who had the trophy refused to hand it over, and I couldn't care less, really. Like, it's, I don't really need a trophy, and the whole purpose was to promote biodiesel fuel, and we did a pretty decent job on that. But what happened through those 3 years that I was on that boat, setting the records, but also all this time spent on these oceans, was marine conservation started getting under my skin. And on the first Pacific crossing, we were stopping at these amazing remote atolls and seeing the huge amount of wildlife that even a relatively small coral system will support. And then as soon as we get in an area that has fishing in it, some areas dead. And so it started to get under my skin, and it kind of took the whole 3 years. And once we got the record and completed the sponsor obligations, there was this time it was like, what am I going to do now? And it's funny how if you start working on something you believe in, it is really hard to go back and work 9 to 5, really hard. And that was the dilemma that I had. And so this marine conservation kind of got under my skin. I've got this amazing boat. Is there a way I can piece these two together? And at the time, Sea Shepherd were starting to do work in Antarctica, trying to stop Japanese whaling. I flew to the States, met with the leader, and basically came together with a deal that would see me go to Antarctica on the Yeti deal.
Okay, go ahead.
So I went with them down to Antarctica and did my best. But then a year later, sort of my relationship with Sea Shepherd became a little bit awkward. And I think in some ways I was a square peg in a round hole kind of thing. And I decided, you know, like, I still want to do marine conservation. How can I best do that? And that is a dilemma. So many people face that. There's a lot of people want to go and work on animals or work on marine conservation, but it's really difficult. How do you do that?
It's overwhelming.
Yeah.
And the numbers are
in my case, it's kind of like either you go full-time, but how are you going to get paid? Or do you have a day job and you do it in the evenings and spare time? Do you have a job that pays really well that lets you take 6 months off? But all of the ways you look at it is really difficult. And what I'd found when I was running Earth Race doing that biofuel thing, I was very poor at raising money. And I hated begging for money. And I didn't want to be in a position where I'm going around begging for money to go and do what I think what's important to me. It's often quite hard making someone else care about rhino or elephants or sharks or fish. Most people don't really care. And they certainly don't care enough to go give a Pete Bethune $100. So the idea I came up with was a television show. And one of the things that had become evident to me in my time in Antarctica was Whale Wars was this television show that was very good at promoting whaling as an issue. And so I saw the opportunity, A, the television network can give me some money to go running its missions, but B, it has a secondary role of raising awareness about these issues. And I was very conscious of wanting to highlight multiple issues. I didn't want it to just be about whaling or just be about dolphins. I wanted to have every episode is about shark finning or elephant poaching or marine protected areas or the Barrier Reef or whatever it is. I thought there was merit in having a series that highlighted multiple conservation issues and puts them in the public domain and raises that public awareness about. And so that was kind of where it sort of ended up. We went to Africa and filmed a pilot episode to do with the seal clubbing that happens there. But one of the things with my work is it is high risk. And we've had several gunfights in different areas, and the networks are very wary of being exposed to those risks. If a network like, say, Discovery comes and signs up Pete Bethune and they own the show, in some ways they own the risk as well. And I remember I had a meeting with a guy from Discovery, and he said, Pete, what happens if one of our cameramen gets shot on while you're filming? And I looked at him, I said, it's going to make great telly. And it wasn't
That's
really,
not what he wanted to
wasn't
hear.
The answer they were looking for. And so in the end, the networks basically all dropped me. Now, the networks, they liked the show, but they didn't want to be exposed to that risk. And especially when once you're starting to take on like illegal gold miners and illegal fishermen, a lot of them are armed, and they got no qualms about opening fire on people.
And the illegal gold miners are destroying. How are they destroying the environment with their poisoning or something?
We covered illegal gold mining in Costa Rica in a place called Corcovado National Park, and the gold miners, they use cyanide to help separate the gold from the silt, and the cyanide is in the waterway, and so there's a downstream effect of a lot of wildlife getting killed. They trash the environment, but the worst thing they do is they shoot wildlife and live off it. Because it's a long way in the jungle. Corcovado National Park is massive. And so they hike a long way and they take in coffee and noodles and spices. And then they go shooting agouti and picaree and all of these animals that are, say, food for jaguar or food for puma, or that are an important part of that ecosystem. They all get wiped out. And we found it there when, as soon as you got in an area that had illegal gold mining, there was no wildlife there. Not even the monkeys are left. It's all gone. You know, you still got insects and birds hanging around, but nothing of any size. And you see it in spawn in the tracks. You know, you get a nice sort of watering hole or an area that's got lots of mud, completely devoid of prints. And yet you get an area that hasn't had gold mining and an enormous amount of wildlife there. So the gold miners, they are toxic on the environment there. And, you know, in the end, you know, they know if they get caught, they're in for some serious prison time. And they do generally all have weapons. So, you know, we've had some...
So you have the authority to catch these people, hand them over to whoever it is in whatever country you are, and then they will take it from there?
Yeah, the general rule we try and use is we will either have local enforcement units with us, so it's a joint effort, or we'll have an agreement where if we catch someone and we gather the evidence, we hand that over to you and you will prosecute them. Not always possible. Like in Africa, for example, with their fisheries, the legislation in fisheries is so poor. I'll give you an example with Liberia, where the maximum fine there equates to about $150 for illegal fishing. So you bring a Korean vessel in, and, you know, $150, I don't care. I just pay it and you can go back out fishing. But the strength we have there is that if you can get those fishermen put in prison. African prisons are dangerous places, and if you know, a little wee Asian men, if they're in there for a month or two, they will come out with HIV, no two ways about it. And so very often what happens is there's a negotiated settlement, and the company's agent is called in, they meet with the government. Sometimes we would sit in on those meetings and, you know, basically say, like you need to just come up with a cash settlement and pay it to the government. And so, you know, we just try and make sure that there's penalty to the fishermen. It's not always possible to have it go through an official judicial process because of the way the local system is, but we just work with, we do the best with what we've got. And
so Discovery dropped you. So who are you with now?
So Discovery dropped us, and we went to Nat Geo and all the rest of them. But and what happened was that the TV show was going to fall over, and then I had a guy, Brian Mead, who had done some pretty cool shows over in Europe. He called me up and he said, why don't we just go and film it, and you know, you raise some money. And so what I did is I went out and loaned a whole lot of money. I talked some people who...
So an independent documentary type
effectively,
series thing.
Yeah, effectively. We went out and filmed another 7 episodes. So it gave us a total of 8. So, and we completed the whole show. And then we went back around to these networks. So instead of them commissioning the show where they own it, they simply buy it as an acquisition. And we had a network, both Discovery and Pivot made offers on it. And Pivot, which is a US network, very supportive of our work. And the guy, Jeff Skoll, who owned the network, he was really supportive. And so we signed up with Pivot, and they took it. And then I think it's been sold in about sort of 18 or 19 other countries now. So it's kind of getting out there. And, it doesn't air in every country. And sometimes it's on a small network, and sometimes it gets on a big network. And it's, I just leave that to the distributors. They sell the show, and every now and then there's a, you know, there'll be some money transferred into my account, and it's normally gone in
you
about 12
lunch.
Hours.
So when you're boarding the Japanese ship, it did work out. Thankfully, you got the results that you were looking for. How did you figure that out? That, okay, we do this, this is what's going to happen.
I just took a punt that Japanese media would cover the story. I knew it would be a big story outside of Japan, but the real hope was that Japan would also cover the story, and that is what eventuated. But it was a risk. And I could have ended up with some serious prison time there too. Like at one stage, my lawyers came in to see me. I'd been in there for about, I think it was about 2 months by now. My lawyers came and saw me and they said, you may end up getting between 2 and 5 years on this. Like the prosecution are going to ask for 5 years. And I'd be a very bitter man. If that was 5 years ago, if I was only coming out of prison now, be one very angry man. You know, life's too short to run around being angry. You know, I didn't want that. And in some ways, the turning point on the trial was I spoke 10 minutes of Japanese in the trial, but I learnt it by rote. I don't speak Japanese, but I wrote down what I wanted to say. In the final day of court, I got to say a statement.
So the
my lawyers, they convert it to being a very contrite speech where basically I'm sort of saying, look, I'm really sorry for what's happened. The hard bit here, they fabricated an assault charge. So I got 5 convictions. 4 of them I agree with: disruption of business, possession of knife, destruction of property, and boarding a boat without permission. Those 4 convictions, no problem. I did it, you know, do me whatever. But they charged me with assault. And what happened was, it was these 2 Japanese with the impulse guns shooting pepper spray. They shot into the breeze and came back over. They blamed that on me, and I got charged and convicted of assault, and it was very unfair. And for me to be up in court with these clowns in front of me who shot themselves saying, we think this man should be punished very heavily because of what he did to us, it's not an easy thing to face. And for me then to go turn up there and ask their forgiveness is not easy. But my lawyers have made clear, you need to show contrition and you need to apologise. And if you do that, it's going to help your case. Otherwise, you may be here for 5 years. And so I learned this 10 minutes of Japanese, and I just learned it by rote. Like, they would say what it is, and then I would write down as it sounded in English, and then I would practice that, and the next day the lawyers would be back, and it took me about 3 weeks to get that nailed. But in the end, I didn't need my papers, I just read it out. And I knew which words to accentuate. Like, one of the strengths I have many weaknesses, but one of my strengths is I'm a good talker, I'm a good orator, and I understand how to connect with people through language. And when I learnt the speech, I knew which words were really important I remember a few little snippets of it. One was Bakuhatsui Karyo Uchikomareti Chion Agashinagara Shindakimas. And effectively that means the whale is harpooned in the back and it bleeds out to death. But I knew which words of that were the really important ones. And so, and I remember when I got out, the one of the prison guards who was in there, he starts speaking to me in Japanese because he thinks I'm fluent. Like, hell no, mate. You know, what you saw out there, that's not. Yeah, let's try a little bit of English. But I think that my lawyer said afterwards, they said that was probably the turning point in the court case. So if they charge you with something in Japan, you will be found guilty. Their conviction rate is over 98.5%. The odds of this white guy getting off were pretty small. But what it did do was that I think the Japanese, they'd maybe recognise that, you know, hey, this guy...
But the media, the rest of the world had got it at this stage too, so they knew they were being focused on.
Yeah, the story was everywhere. It was everywhere. Yeah. It's funny how, you know, it's funny how I look back on it. Like at the time I was a bit angry, and I got out. I was messed up. I saw on my second night in prison, I saw an 18-year-old kid get raped. And up until then,
18-year-old kid?
Yeah. And up until then, it kind of seemed like a joke. And prison was a dark place, and I hated it. They put me in the highest security ward they have in the country. If you're in a medium security or a low security prison in Japan, it's a holiday camp. But the maximum security is a tough place. And I was this who's who of Japanese criminality, and this little wee white boy from New Zealand who boarded a boat without permission. You know, in the scheme of things, you know, I was this little wee white boy and amongst some pretty nasty people. And when I saw the rape happen, this was a nightmare. And food was horrible. And I came out of there, I was like 60 kilos in weight. I'm 75 now. Like, you look at me, like, I don't have extra fat on me. To lose 15 kilos, I was emaciated when I got out. And I was a mess in the head. You know, I paid a heavy price for my time in Japan. And it took me a long time to get my head straight when I got out.
So what's coming up? What's next?
So at the moment, we're in pre-production for series 3 of the show. Pivot as a network have closed down, but we've got a couple of networks looking at it in the US, and we've still got the networks in Germany and other where that is still keen on series 3. So pre-production series 3, we've got a new boat we're building. One of the things with illegal fishing is it's very hard for us to do blue water patrol. So when I say blue water, it's offshore. Coastal patrols, you can do that in small boats and we're quite effective at that, but getting offshore to where the tuna boats and the big purse seiners and trawlers are, the moment we don't really have the vessel to do that. So we're trying to raise $10 million to fund that.
How many people does the boat hold? 26?
The boat has a crew of 26, but it's a big vessel. Like, it's 60 metres long. And if you had it, let's say...
Feet, right?
It's 195 feet. Yeah, 60 metres. So if you had that in port, you could have 200 guests on the back deck. Like, it is a big vessel. But the rest of the boat is relatively functional and semi kind of military in nature, but it has got some
military in the fact that it can't be found. What else? No weapons, I presume, on board.
No, we'll have weapons on board. Yeah, it's got an armory in it, and it when you're boarding foreign vessels fishing illegally, if you don't have weapons, you might as well piss in the wind. You know, you're not going to help things. But
about then the it's always been. You haven't been fired on because Greenpeace or whatever don't have weapons. So now when they learn, okay, these guys may have weapons, won't they start firing at you?
My job is first and foremost to bring my crew back safely. And secondly, it is to contribute in terms of arresting the crew. And one of the things we find is if my team goes out and we look formidable, there's a term that we use as perceived overwhelming force. These are generally fishermen, and they are criminals, and they are at times armed. But if they see a perceived overwhelming force, they don't want a gunfight, and they will give up. And I've seen that time and time again. If we go out and look really professional and well-armed, they will just give up. As soon as we start to look Mickey Mouse, or we are not armed, and they think we could shoot these guys and get away with it, that's when I run the risk of not bringing my crew back. So when we're boarding foreign vessels, we will try and always be armed and always be professional in what we do, so that these fishermen, and my job is not to shoot them either, I have no ambition to have gunfights. You know, as soon as those bullets start firing, people are liable to be shot, sometimes killed. I don't want that. And so weapons are just a necessary part of this job.
I can talk to you for hours. So thank you so much, Pete, for all this time. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, awesome, Sarah. Really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks. Thank you. All right, bye-bye.